Oh, good morning, everyone. Thinking this week, Stuart McLean passed away this week, and you know, it was I think about 8 years ago. Chris and I were driving, listening to an episode of Vinyl Cafe, and I remember we can't remember who it was, but one of us saying, "Wouldn't it be great if church was kind of like that?" And so we've, over the past sort of 7 years, sort of tried to explore this idea. What would happen if you got into Rome and there were some stories and some good music? And anyway, a bit odd having Stuart pass away this week. I know as Canadians, I think there's something, he tapped into something kind of magical and special. So transition that from spiritual warfare. That ought to be interesting. And I got to be honest, this morning I'm a little... I don't know if I've got this one figured out. Not that I ever have anything figured out, but I'm concerned this could be a little bit more jumbled than usual, so bear with me here. But I'm driving, listening to a podcast called Devilpalooza, and it's hosted by these guys who do homebrewed Christianity, and the whole thing was fascinating. It was Trip Fuller, a few other guys. They were having some beers, doing this podcast, chatting about the devil, spiritual warfare. And they had on three distinguished guests: Richard Beck, who has contributed a lot to this series, N.T. Wright, who's done the same, and Greg Boyd. And so they sort of dealt with them in order. And so Richard Beck comes on. It was a fascinating chat. And then N.T. Wright comes on. And it's just the whole... podcast was this really jovial. They were laughing about sort of spiritual warfare, the devil, why we sort of take these things lightly. And N.T. Wright, of course, in his British accent, sort of always makes interesting points. At one point said, why do progressives have a hard time thinking through spiritual warfare? And I love what N.T. Wright said. He said, well, fundamentalists don't have the monopoly on closed-mindedness. And I thought, oh, that was just really, really clever. But there's all this sort of joking and whatnot. And then Greg Boyd comes on to the podcast. And he proceeds to tell a story, and he starts, the whole atmosphere was jovial, and he said, you know, we're kind of laughing about this, and it's good to discuss it. He's like, but we have to remember how serious this actually is. And he proceeds to tell a story about the first time that he came into contact with someone he considered demon-possessed. And it was an sensational story, a spooky story. Talks about how he was asked to meet with this woman who people thought were demon-possessed. So he met with her in a Dairy Queen. And as he's talking to her, every time he mentions the word Jesus, she starts to twitch. And as the conversation progressed, at one point she sort of snapped and ran over to the wall and started scratching it. And said, as you can imagine, this wasn't good for business. So everybody cleared out of Dairy Queen. The manager was quite upset about that. And so eventually it just got so out of control. He called the cops. The cops came. They sort of took her. Later on that day, he got a call from the family. It was desperate for him to come out to their farm where she was. Apparently, when she had been released and taken home, she had completely destroyed the home, and the family had managed to corral her into this encampment sort of in the back where the horses usually were. It's a bit of a barbed wire encampment. And so Greg Boyd goes out there, and he's talking with her, and at one point, he's talking with her, trying to get her to sort of calm down, and she takes a piece of barbed wire, wraps it around her neck, and starts sawing. And he tells the story of how he had to then jump into the enclosure and restrain her until the police could show up. And so into this conversation about taking spiritual warfare lightly and chatting about all these things, Greg Boyd comes in and says, this is serious. And here's the thing, I'm listening to this driving, and I certainly don't want to suggest this story is untrue because, well, there are equally weird stories like that in Scripture. I have no reason to doubt a story like this, apart from the fact that it just doesn't match my own experience. But what I think about a story like this is what happens most often in my world is that there's any time there's talk of spiritual warfare, it almost always ends with a sensational story like that. Which is fine. I don't doubt that spiritual warfare is something that is at times incredibly sensational, but it just doesn't match my experience. And so what I want to do is talk about spiritual warfare this morning in a very dull and boring way, but hopefully make that interesting. Because my hunch is this. For those of us here who are sort of skeptical, doubting, disenchanted with faith, oftentimes what happens is whenever faith is sort of sensationalized, it only adds a level of skepticism to our faith, right? Feels unrelatable. So this morning, I want to dive in. How do we talk about spiritual warfare? Well, what I want to do is I want to look at two passages of Scripture that sort of have phrases in them that I think are interesting, and we'll sort of launch from there. First is in Ephesians 2. We're told this. As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air. So apparently there's a kingdom in the air and a ruler of it. Or 1 John 4:1, beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God. So now there's spirits that we need to discern and test. So whenever you come to Scripture, it's like, this seems so sensational. There's a ruler in the air. There's spirits that we need to test. I mean, what do you do with that? Well, welcome to the zeitgeist, an idea that I hope can help us move forward. You see, zeitgeist, many of you maybe seen the movie called Zeitgeist, but it's a German word, and it means this, the defining spirit or mood of a particular time or place. Winter Sleep song talked about that. Finding spirit or mood of a time. Each era, we're sort of told, has a sort of nature or climate to it. And so I'm hoping that this lens can perhaps help us as we think about spiritual warfare. When Scripture talks about there being spirits or an entity that rules the air, maybe this zeitgeist idea can help us. Perhaps you could think of a spiritual warfare or zeitgeist like this. Like, think about the scent that a home has. You ever notice that? Am I the only one? You go over to somebody's house and their house has a scent to it? Yeah? I still remember. It's weird the things that you remember as a kid. I remember the first time that this became obvious to me. As kids, we always, every Sunday, our family either had somebody in for lunch or we would go somewhere. And I remember going over to the Cleveland's house. Old couple in their 80s. They invited us over, all of us young kids, for some reason. I'm like, oh, this is going to be the most boring time ever. So we just sat there with these old people, and we're young kids. They had no toys. It was awful. But I still remember so distinctly in my mind the smell of their house. It had a scent to it. It was like a mix of, like, mothballs, baked beans, and death approaching, you know? Like, it was just this smell, this scent that you just... Oh, it's there. I think that's what we're talking about with testing, discerning the spirits. What is the scent of the home of our culture? Or air. It's no accident, I think, that Scripture talks about Satan as the ruler of the air. Why? Because air is everywhere but invisible. We exist inside of it, but it's unseen. It mostly goes unnoticed. Or it's like the little parable of the old fish who swims by two younger fish and says to the two younger fish, hey guys, how's the water today? And the fish say, what is water? It's this idea that we're swimming in something, but at times we're totally unaware that it's there. And so talk about discerning the spirits, the zeitgeist, all that stuff. It's sort of to identify the scent of our time. To discern the spirits, resist the devil is about identifying the zeitgeist. And what I think it means is this, acknowledging that there is a spiritual force that guides and influences everything, but is rarely recognized, noticed, or questioned. I mean, who of us notices the air? What fish notices the water? What person notices the smell of their own home? And here's the thing. This is where I think it doesn't need to be sensational at all. Consider Hannah Arendt. She tells an interesting story that's very different, I would say, than the story of that Greg Boyd tells. Hannah Arendt, in her book Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil, she came to this conclusion that evil, rather being than being sensational, was actually boring, banal, ordinary, and common. She wrote her book after taking in the trial of a Nazi war criminal by the name of Adolf Eichmann. And this was a very personal assignment for Hannah because she was a Jewish philosopher who fled Germany during the 1930s, during Hitler's rise to power. And so when Eichmann came to trial for his part in the Holocaust, she wanted to witness it firsthand. So she flew over and covered the whole trial. What she wanted in her mind was to confront evil, confront a man that she believed was a monster. But what she found during the trial was something different altogether. Eichmann, for his part, he's what some people refer to as the architect of the Holocaust. He was the man who, for lack of a better phrase, handled the logistical challenges of deporting Jews to the ghettos first, and then, of course, out to the concentration camps and to their deaths. In a very real sense, he was sort of the office manager, the logistics specialist behind the Holocaust. And after the war, he escaped to Argentina. Israeli forces caught up with him in 1960, brought him back, put him on trial. I'm actually told, I didn't know this, this was the first internationally televised trial of our time. And Hannah Arendt went there to see him in person. Her assessment of Eichmann was profound. She said after taking in the trial, what she learned about him is that he seemed to be ordinary. Even polite. She came to think over the course of the trial that he was more stupid than sinister. She concluded this way about him. She said, everybody could see that this man was not a monster, but it was difficult indeed not to suspect that he was a clown. So why would he participate in the Holocaust at that such high level, that integral level? The answer disturbed her. Throughout the trial, it came down to the fact that he was a simple man who loved his country. He trusted his superiors. He was just a good citizen who never questioned orders from above. He was the kind of guy who just went to work, did his job every day. He never thought to question those in power above him. And therein, I would say, lies the task of spiritual warfare. And this is why Hannah coined the term the banality of evil. She used it to describe Eichmann. Eichmann, in his ordinariness, couldn't discern or smell the foul scent of his own home country. He couldn't tell that the water of Nazism that he was swimming in was toxic. He couldn't tell that the air of Nazism that he was breathing in was suffocating. He just conformed to the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, like so many other people did. And I think this starts to get at the heart of what it means to discern the spirit. Spiritual warfare is to resist unthinking conformity to the spirit of the age. And this is, I think, what makes evil anything but sensational. We've talked about over the past few weeks, how does love start to get traction in the world? Well, here, I think, is the heart of how evil starts to get traction in the world. When we fail to stop and discern the spirit, the climate, the scent of our time. So what I want to do is try to flesh that out a little bit more this morning. Walter Wink, in his time, a profound theologian scholar, he wrote 5 books on the nature of the spiritual powers. And he has a wonderful suggestion that I think has been very helpful for me. But in terms of understanding the spiritual, he says we need to move away from this up-down paradigm. Like when we think of the spiritual, we think spiritual is what is up or sort of out there. And he says we should instead move to an idea of the spiritual as inside out. The spiritual is the inside of a person, the inside of an institution, a nation. The physical is the outside. And I think we get this on a personal level, right? When I look at each of you, I can see your physicality. But what is happening on the inside of you? What is it that you love? What are you scared of? What do you care about? What motivates you? What drives you? Those are the questions of the soul, the spirit. The inside of you, the unseen part of you, is the spiritual side of you. And what Wink suggests is this, is it's the same thing for families, churches, workplaces, organizations, companies, social groups, nations. Inside of all of those things, there's a spirit, values, beliefs, practices, customs. Every group or organization has a zeitgeist. I mean, consider Nexus, right? From the outside, the physical, you can say Nexus has a website. It has a Facebook presence. You can sort of see what we do here on Sundays, but there might also be an ethos, a spirit to Nexus. The difference is paramount. We could say on paper, one of our practices is we are very, very welcoming. We're a welcoming people. But somebody walking in here might experience a very different spirit. It's possible they could walk in here and think, this place doesn't feel very welcoming. Hopefully that's not the case, but it's possible. The difference between what is seen and what is unseen. Consider the places that you've worked in your life. There's a zeitgeist to workplaces, right? A spirit, a climate to them. And sometimes it can affect your mood, your health. I've had a number of jobs. Most of them have been pretty decent, but I used to work at Loblaws, you know, the one on Maple Grove Road. I've never experienced a more soul-crushing, dehumanizing place in my entire life. On paper, it's just easy, right? Loblaws, you go around, and we would ride around on these things, pick groceries, and there was a spirit there. People stole all the time, just stealing all the time, the food, because you're picking up groceries. And you had to work by the numbers. If you weren't fast enough, you would get in trouble. If you didn't pick the groceries fast enough, you're in trouble. And sort of the spirit was, well, if you're not fast enough, you just keep working through your breaks. You have to hit your numbers. There was just this, it's hard to describe, but just this sort of, oh, I hated that place. I felt like it crushed my soul every time I went in there. And I think most of us can kind of relate to that, right? Sometimes a workplace might say they're about this, but the environment inside is very different. And so spiritual warfare is about what? It's about attending to the inside, the unseen spiritual aspect of all things. Could be our own hearts. Could be the inside of a church, a neighborhood, a country, an organization. But the call is to attend to the inner. Jesus picks up on this powerfully when he calls out the Pharisees. And he has this group of seven woes that he pronounces on the Pharisees. And they are harsh. Sorry, I got to grab a drink of water here. Let me show you that here, though. Says this, he's talking to the Pharisees who are essentially the religious elite, the religious establishment. He says this, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside will also be clean. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You're like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you're full of hypocrisy and wickedness." For Jesus, it was all about attending to the inside, the unseen, the zeitgeist. That's what spiritual warfare is about, attending to the inside, unseen, spiritual aspect of all things. And this is where I'm a little unsure of myself here, because I don't want to sort of just leave it there. I wanted to talk about three sort of practical issues, ways we think about spiritual warfare today. So I thought we'd talk about some light issues like racism, domestic violence, and rape culture. So that's where we'll go. Fun. Racism. Last summer, Richard Beck told the story of a time he took a bus tour with black preachers to the most significant civil rights areas in the South. And so what happened is there were 12 white pastors, 12 black pastors traveling together on bus going to all the significant civil rights places in the U.S. South. And on the bus with him was a man by the name of Fred Gray. He's a famous civil rights lawyer. Fred is a preacher. He's in his 80s today. But he was also the famous civil rights lawyer who defended Rosa Parks, MLK during the Montgomery bus boycott. Gray, I think you could say, is one of the most significant civil rights lawyers in the history of America. And Gray, at 86 years old today, he and Beck were talking on the bus, and Gray was reflecting on his legacy and the racial tensions that still exist in America today. And what he told Beck was this. He said this: I was able to change the laws, but I couldn't change the hearts. Those are powerful words from a man who knows all about racism. And it drives home to me an important point. We must address the outside aspect of issues like racism, yes. But if we don't go deeper, there's still something missing. Laws exist, I think, in many ways to hide and inhibit hate and prejudice and racism, but it can't get rid of it. To get rid of it, we must attend to the heart, the unseen, the zeitgeist, the spirit of racism in our culture. Because if we don't, all it takes is the right person or the wrong person in power, and suddenly what is hidden becomes visible again. And we're seeing this play out in Canada today. There's a bill or motion in our parliament that wants to address the growing problem of Islamophobia in our country. It's a motion designed to protect Muslims from acts of hate, hate speech. Here's the thing I would say about laws or policies or motions. We need them to inhibit and keep the inner demons of humanity in check. But the motion will ultimately only address our speech. That's the outside. Spiritual warfare is the task of addressing the hate behind the speech. At some point, we have to acknowledge there's a larger spiritual battle going on in the hearts of us as individuals and as a culture. Emotion will help to inhibit those demons, but eventually we have to do the work of working on our hearts. And I think this is a critical thing for us here in Canada, particularly, because this stuff is going on. Or consider domestic violence. You know, one of the things that I love about alcohol is that it provides a way, I think, for what is inside of people to get out. And sometimes that's a great and enjoyable thing. In high school, I had a buddy named Jason Cripps was his name. And he was the kind of guy on weekends we'd have campfires and we'd have a few beers. And at the end of the night, he was always that guy. You know the guy I'm talking about. He got very sentimental, right? The end of the evening would come around and he would just, every weekend, sort of the same thing. He'd love to tell us how much he loved us. And Jason was such a gentle guy. What was happening when he had a few drinks is, it's not that the alcohol was making him more loving, it sort of provided a way for that to get out. And it was brilliant. It was so much fun. He was a great guy, absolutely loved it. Alcohol can help showcase what is fun and enjoyable inside of us, but we also know that it works in the opposite way, right? I think some of us have probably had the experience of being around a person who, after a few drinks, doesn't become more fun or enjoyable, but becomes more crass, becomes angrier, rude, more sexualized, you could say. And it's not that the alcohol makes the person do these things. It sort of, I think, unleashes what's already inside of us. Sometimes it's a wonderful thing. Other times there are demons inside of us that I think should stay there. I want to tell you a story about Carl. My mother, when she was 2 years old, her biological parents gave her up. They couldn't take care of her, so they gave her up to her and her siblings to some friends. So she was essentially adopted by a guy named Carl and Wilma. And Carl had fought in World War II. He didn't like to talk about it, but he had fought in World War II, been on the front lines. And when he got home, he liked to drink. And when he drank, he became mean, increasingly mean, and violent towards Wilma, my mother's kind of mother, stepmother, something like that. And my mother will still tell stories today. You know how people have like defining narratives about their lives? My mother has a defining narrative about her life, and it's the domestic violence that she saw growing up. Carl coming home from the bar, drinking, hitting Wilma. Bad, 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 bad. And it getting worse and worse. And the methods of violence that he used on her, the screaming, sometimes neighbors would come, have to control him, the police would get involved, put him away for a few days, but she wouldn't leave, she wouldn't press charges. This continuing spiral of violence, domestic violence. And here's the thing, how do you stop domestic violence from happening? Now, here's the thing, obviously, we need laws in place that make it illegal and punishable when you hit someone else. That's clear. But here's the thing. Carl's real problem wasn't necessarily alcohol. It was that World War II left him with inner demons that he didn't know what to do with. And, you know, it's easy in hindsight. Today we would say, oh, he clearly had PTSD. But back in the 60s, that wasn't diagnosed yet. And so this to me is an interesting sort of story, the way the political needs to address the fact that there needs to be punishment or some sort of inhibiting factor, laws, policies in place that keep us from hitting people. But what Carl really needed was someone or something to address the inner demons, what was going on inside. What he really needed was someone, something to speak to his spirit, right? This is the thing, politics, laws, policies, we need them to inhibit the inner demons that we all have. We need them in place to help prevent what is inside from spilling out. But here's the thing, if we don't address the heart, the inside aspect of issues plaguing our world, if we don't attend to the spiritual side of issues like domestic violence, they're never going to completely go away. The real issue for Carl was not whether it was right to hit another person. Mother tells stories about the next morning how he felt awful. Every single time, felt awful. I already knew what he was doing was wrong. He needed somebody to help him address what was going on inside. Or consider rape culture. If you don't know what rape culture is, I've got a little thing on the screen here that can help you. Next slide. Help you think about it. Essentially, rape culture is when you live in an environment that normalizes and trivializes sexual abuse. And many today would say that between print ads, television, media, pornography that oftentimes glorifies the objectification, dehumanization of women, we live in a rape culture environment that normalizes sexual abuse, even if it's only in subtle ways. And this week, I don't know if you were watching the news, we saw a fascinating and disturbing an example of this. This was all over CBC and Globe and Mail. This week, there's a bar in Toronto that put up this sign. I won't repeat it for you. You can make what you will of it. But this Toronto bar called Locals Only put up this sign, and of course, quite the storm erupted over this. Eventually, they released a statement saying, okay, one of our employees did that. We've since fired him. This doesn't represent Locals Only as a bar. But then somebody came back and said, that's great that you fired that person, but why then do you have always signs like this up? Next slide. Here's some other slides that this bar has put up over time. And in my mind, this is an outward physical example of the zeitgeist of our time. If you want to discern the spirit and inner climate of our culture around sex is disturbing. And what has happened is this, is into our cultural mess around sex, what's ended up happening is our cultural mantra has become to preach the sexual ethic of consent, which is good. If not something that seems intuitively obvious to me, of course you need consent before engaging with someone sexually. This seems to me almost so basic as to be absurd, but apparently we still need to learn this culturally. So fair enough, this is good and needed. Let's talk about consent. But here's the thing, if we're going to really address rape culture, how the objectification and dehumanization of people happens through sex, it's going to take a whole lot more than talking about consent. We're going to need to talk about what's inside of us as sexual beings. We're going to need to address the spirit of our time, the zeitgeist. we're going to need to talk about things like lust. Because here's the reality in my mind. Consent doesn't even begin to get at the heart, the spirit, the unseen forces at work when it comes to sex. Consent doesn't protect any of us from the disillusionment you can experience when you feel that you've been used, lied to, rejected, discarded, betrayed sexually. Consent doesn't protect me or you from rejection. Because here's the reality. You can convince someone to consent to have sex with you and still not care at all about them. You can convince someone to consent to have sex with you and still hurt them in a profound way. And this, in my mind, is why we need to get at the spirit of the age. If we're going to do spiritual warfare with the spirit and ethos of our sexualized culture, we need to speak more about physical intimacy being protected and guarded by equal measures of emotional intimacy and commitment. And that's why the band this morning played Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, a song made famous by Carole King, the Shirelles. It's a fascinating song, but it raises an interesting question. It's one thing to go to bed with someone. It's another thing to continually love them the next morning. And the truth is this, many people are radically unprepared for how the act of sex leaves them feeling exposed, vulnerable, needy, in ways we could not have imagined. And the truth is, I think sometimes like, oh, now you're starting to sound pretty traditional and stodgy. You know what? I don't care if I sound that way. Because the reality is this, if we're going to get at the spirit of the problem, the zeitgeist of the problem, consent is a good start, but it's not nearly enough. And you see, it's not about pleasure or sex or orgasm being intrinsically bad. The truth is this, the pursuit of pleasure in our culture is causing us to hurt other people. And if we want to call it the zeitgeist of our time, this might be a good place to start, the pursuit of pleasure. When pleasure becomes the goal, the animating spirit of our times, people get used and they get discarded. And we need to call these spirits out. Call them out, resist them. Let me close with this. Spiritual warfare is about attending to the spirit of our time, but we can never divorce that from the personal. It's about what's going on inside of us. What I love about that U2 song the band played this morning is the blatant hypocrisy in it. How you can denounce lust and it still go on in your head. How you can denounce excess and yet still have a gorgeous big house. I just love it because what so often happens is it's one thing to have a sort of seen public air about you, but what's going on inside is often a bigger struggle. The reality is spiritual warfare is often a personal, private, intimate battle against our own inner demons. I mean, listen to what scripture says a few places here. James 4. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire but do not have, so you kill. You covet, but you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. Submit yourselves then to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Or in Ephesians? Peter. Be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith. And then finally, Ephesians, there we go. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. You know, I think it's interesting that today, I think we're embarrassed to talk about sin. It's become one of those words we don't like to talk about. I don't like to talk about because it feels, sin. You sound judgmental. But the reality is this, to resist the devil oftentimes means that we have to confront the reality that inside there's some dark things going on. And even though we don't like the idea of sin, the reality is this. Even think about this. An atheist even has to say no to personal temptations that draw them away from their vision of what makes the world a good place, what it means to live a good life. We have to talk about personal morality because here's the crux of it for me. Can you really talk about the root causes of sex trafficking, sexual abuse, inappropriate and offensive bar signs, pornography that objectifies and dehumanizes? Can you really talk about those things without eventually having a conversation about lust? I just don't know how you can do that. Can you really talk about poverty, systematic poverty, without eventually having a conversation about personal greed, consumerism, materialism? I don't see how you can do it. Can you have a conversation about violence without eventually having a conversation around personal prejudice and hate? I don't see how you can do it. Eventually, the zeitgeist that's out there of our time becomes about the zeitgeist within us. Personal sin or moral failures create systematic political evils, and systematic political evils create greater personal sin and moral failures. Two sides of the same coin. And so our task, spiritual warfare, is to discern, name the sinister spirits of our time, called to name the zeitgeist and resist it, realizing that the sinister spirits at work in our world are also at work within us. The resistance must take place both on the outside and the inside. But I think the reality is for all of us, it starts here, inside, in our hearts, in our spirits. And so I'd say this, may each of us find it within us to begin the resistance internally. If we want to fight hate, greed, lust, violence, the real battle is not just out there, it starts in here. In fact, I think it might be the most important way we can contribute individually to the resistance movement that Jesus initiated 2,000 years ago.